I'd like to call the meeting to order. Good afternoon, everybody. We have some minutes. We have the, well, quorum is present. We have the minutes of January 23rd. Representative Zerwas, would you like to move the minutes?
Would I? I'll make that motion, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. Representative Zerwas moves to approve the minutes of January 23rd. Is there any discussion? All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The minutes are approved. Thank you. Today, members, we're going to have some overviews about the very important topic of autism. And I think we're having a little trouble with our technology here. And we do have a slide presentation from our first speaker, and you do have copies of that in your packets. So is there a good hope that we'll be able to get that going?
You can.
Okay. Well, maybe while Mr. Bergeron and works to try to get that going, maybe we can, if our testifier is able to start without that, maybe we could do that because we want to make sure that we have time for everybody who's on our agenda. So I'd like to welcome Mike Wassmer from Autism Speaks to the committee. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you very much, Chair Liebling, members of the committee. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you all today. My name is Mike Wassmer, and I am the Associate Director for State Government Affairs at Autism Speaks. Autism Speaks is the world's leading science and advocacy organization for autism. And we've been involved in most of the now 32 states that have passed legislation requiring that insurance cover the diagnosis and treatments for autism. What I hope to address with you today is just a general overview of autism, what it is, some of the common features of autism, and our experience in passing autism insurance reform legislation across the country. And we do have some good claims data from some of the earliest states that have passed this legislation to share as well. My daughter was diagnosed with autism when she was 2.5. She had a regressive form of autism, so up until a year of age, she seemed to be developing typically. But at a year of age, her development started to regress to the point where when she was diagnosed, the majority of her developmental skills were assessed at those of a six-month-old. We were very fortunate in that we were able to pay for her services out of pocket when our insurance company denied the coverage. But today she's in eighth grade. She's been in regular education since first grade without an aid. She's making straight A's. She's been in the school play. And she's got a small group of very good friends. So it just is demonstrates that autism is treatable, and provided access to the appropriate care, these children will be able to become self-sufficient, tax-paying citizens. Autism is clearly a public health crisis. The incidence of autism has increased over 1,000-fold in the past 40 years. The current prevalence rate is 1 in every 88 children. We don't know why that is. The majority of what we do at Autism Speaks is science and research into the cause and cure for autism. We know that there is a strong genetic predisposition for autism, but given these prevalence rates increasing so rapidly, it can't be genetics alone. So the bulk of our research today is looking at the interaction between the genes and environment. So you have a genetically predisposed individual, something in the environment is triggering a combination of changes to occur that leads to the constellation of clinical signs that we call autism.
Mr. Wassmer, if I could just stop you for a second. I don't think you maybe just told us a little minute about Autism Speaks, kind of what your organization is. Who is it that you're representing?
We are the world's leading autism science and advocacy organization. And the bulk of what we do is really science. Our advocacy portion is really just a small part of what we do. Most of it is looking at funding research into the cause and treatment for autism.
Okay. Thank you. Please continue. It looks like we're going to have your slides up here in a minute, too.
Very briefly, what is autism? Once upon a time, it was blamed on mothers not being attentive enough to their children and referred to as refrigerator mothers. Fortunately, we no longer believe that and know that it is a condition brought on by no fault of the family. The autism has common features include difficulty in communication skills, social skills, and
you might have to improvise.
That'll work.
Is there handouts they have?
Pardon me?
So they can follow along.
Okay. Wing it here.
Thank you.
So again, I'm sorry. The common features are difficulty in communication, both verbal and nonverbal, difficulty with social interaction, social skills, and children will often have repetitive behaviors. The word autism, if you look at the Diagnostic and Statistics Manual, actually isn't in there anywhere. We use that word to describe multiple diagnoses. The word autism is frequently used interchangeably with autism spectrum disorders. In fact, there are actually three distinct categories of autism within that umbrella term. The current edition of the DSM, which is the DSM-4, uses an umbrella term, pervasive developmental disorders, that encompasses five different diagnoses, including autistic disorder, Asperger's syndrome, and pervasive developmental disorder not otherwise specified. However, the new version of the DSM is coming out in the spring, the content of which has already been agreed upon by the APA, and when that comes out, they won't be using that umbrella term pervasive developmental disorders anymore. They're going to be simply referring to autism spectrum disorders, and all of those distinct diagnoses within that umbrella are going to be subsumed, so we'll just call it autism spectrum disorder. And it is referred to as a spectrum disorder, obviously, because the signs range from very severely affected children who may be nonverbal, no ability to interact, whereas on the lower end or the higher end of the spectrum, you can have a child who, you know, is actually quite verbal, but that ability to speak might be limited to echolalia, where basically you repeat what you hear, or very fixed subjects, which they want to speak about. Recognizing the importance of early intervention for autism, the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends screening at every well visit. So at 18 and 24 months, children are screened by their general pediatrician. However, the general pediatrician is not qualified to make that diagnosis of autism. So if the child flags as having a concern at that visit, they are then referred to a team of specialists, typically a developmental pediatrician, a psychologist, a pediatric neurologist, or frequently a team of specialists. But as demonstrated by my daughter, autism clearly is treatable. Although there is no known cure, children who can't speak can gain the ability to communicate. Children who don't have any interaction skills can learn to interact with others in their environment. The treatment for autism typically includes a behavioral therapy referred to as applied behavior analysis. Other common therapies include speech therapy, occupational therapy, physical therapy, and many children also will require psychological care medication. A little bit about applied behavior analysis. It is, behavior analysis is the science of behavior. So applied behavior analysis basically takes what we know about the principles of behavior and apply it to the child to reinforce positive behaviors and to try to diminish negative and non-productive behaviors. There are different techniques of applied behavior analysis, just as there are different kinds of chemotherapy. There are different techniques of applied behavior analysis. However, they do all have some common features. They are very structured. They are very data-driven. It is intense, one-on-one therapy. And they will provide positive strategies for changing responses or behaviors. What's really interesting is that not only do we see clinical improvement in these children with therapy, but recent studies demonstrate that we also see objective, measurable changes in brain activity as measured by EEG. It is the most commonly prescribed treatment for autism spectrum disorders, and decades of research support its efficacy and use in children with autism. And it's endorsed by many leading national health associations and organizations. But insurers will commonly still deny reimbursement for applied behavior analysis on the assertion that it's experimental. But that argument simply doesn't hold water anymore, and it doesn't not supported by the science at all. I've listed in the presentation some of the organizations that have endorsed it, including the United States Surgeon General, CMS, the National Institute of Mental Health, Centers for Disease Control, National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke, the American Psychological Association. And interestingly, the United States Office of Personnel Management, OPM, is the organization that oversees our federal employees. So basically, they are the largest employer in the country. And up until recently, OPM would not allow reimbursement for this service under the assertion this was educational. However, based on the decades of research, they recently came out with a statement last year recognizing that ABA is a medical therapy and therefore eligible for reimbursement through their health insurance plans. The American Academy of Pediatrics and also the United States Department of Defense, the TRICARE ECHO program has covers therapy for autism, including ABA. Unfortunately, the treatment, when paid for out of pocket, is quite expensive. And it's the therapy, although is based on an individual's strength and weaknesses and is tailored to that individual, in more severely affected cases, the out-of-pocket costs can approach $50,000 a year. Now, that's typically not indefinite. Typically, we're looking at 2, 3, 4 years of intensive therapy and then perhaps some focused therapy later on to address behavioral issues as they arise. Obviously, that's not within the means of most families. We can't pay for that out of pocket. And when that happens, then the child either goes without therapy altogether or they only receive a fraction of the prescribed treatment. It's no different than a person being prescribed chemotherapy. You know, perhaps they are being prescribed 10 doses and they only receive one dose. I mean, obviously, it's not going to be effective if you don't get what is prescribed. And when that happens, these children will end up in very costly special education programs, K through 12, and they will be ultimately dependent on state-funded adult living supports and disability services. What's important to recognize is that this is a very fiscally responsible bill. This is a very fiscally responsible thing to do, and that autism insurance reform saves the state money. Without the appropriate treatment, there have been some long-term studies done that demonstrate the cost to society, the cost to the state, approaches $3.2 million per child if they're not treated appropriately. Autism Speaks has funded several independent actuarial analyses on several of the bills that we have filed across the country. And in those reports, actuary will comment that the cost of autism insurance reform could be recouped in the cost to special education and medical expenses alone. the cost of educating a child with autism, as opposed to the cost of educating a child in a regular education, is 2.9 times the cost. So in the case of my daughter, because she was able to succeed in mainstream and regular ed, you know, we were able to save the state that amount of money alone.
Right.
In special
Mr.
ed.
Rosner, if I could just interject here, I'm not sure members are all aware, maybe they are, that the reason we're talking about insurance reform is that tomorrow in this committee we will be hearing a bill to extend an insurance mandate to cover autism services. So that's why we're, but Mr. Wozner is only here today. He's a guest that we're very fortunate to get today. He lives in Kansas City, I think you said, and
yes, ma'am.
And he's on his way to Hawaii, poor thing, later after he leaves here.
So not for fun. We've got a bill filed there, and I'll be there for 36 hours.
Right, so
I'll probably see the capital in my hotel room.
We couldn't get him tomorrow, so that's why we're previewing a little bit. But I just wanted to frame that for you, why we're talking about this insurance piece today. So please
Thank
continue.
You. We've seen this slide, but this demonstrates the rising prevalence. And, you know, if we consider the cost of not doing it, this is clearly going to be a tsunami of affected individuals and therefore a tsunami of expense to the state if it's not treated appropriately. Recognizing these realities, as I mentioned, there has been a national movement. There are now 32 states that have passed legislation to require coverage for autism. Indiana was the first back in 2001, and there really was no movement until about 2007 when South Carolina became the second state. So the bulk of the states that have passed legislation to address this issue have occurred since 2007. This is a graphic that probably doesn't show very well in black and white or on the screen, but it lists that we color the states green if they have passed a bill that requires coverage for autism. You'll note there's a couple shades of green in there. Kansas and Iowa, those bills only apply to state employees' health plans, whereas the rest of the states that have passed legislation may or may not include their state health plans, but require coverage to all state regulated plans. Ohio is on there as well. That's why the number is 33. That didn't occur via legislation. There is a bill in the works in Ohio to address state funded plans. But in December, Governor Kasich, by executive order, required that state employees' health plans in Ohio require coverage for autism, including an ABA benefit. These bills have enjoyed bipartisan support. Recognizing the fiscal significance of this, it is not difficult to get legislators on both sides of the aisle to understand this. As I mentioned in my introduction, we do have now claims data from some of the states that have passed these bills the earliest. We initially went to the insurance companies to try to get that information, but they weren't very forthcoming, so our approach was to get the information from the state employees' health plans in those states that require that coverage, and we were able to get that data. At this time, this was in 2011 when we were collecting this data, there was only 29 states that had passed, so we narrowed it down to those states that required their state employees to be covered, and we were ultimately able to get data from six states, which I've demonstrated here. The average second year cost of coverage was 31 cents per member per month. Interestingly, we went back and compared the fiscal notes that were prepared for these bills and found that in some cases the overestimates were as high as 1,300%. Some people ask, well, you know, you said earlier that the, you know, in more severely affected children, the cost of coverage can approach $50,000 a year. So how do you go from $50,000 per affected child to 31 cents per member per month? The most common mistakes of folks who are preparing these fiscal notes and aren't familiar with autism are that they will take, you know, the number of estimated individuals with autism and multiply that by 50,000. Although that's the simplest approach, that's inaccurate. for two reasons. One is that, as we mentioned, autism is a spectrum disorder, and it's really only a fraction of the... Computer's not carbon here. There we go. Really, it's only a fraction of the most severely affected children that would ever be prescribed treatment intense enough to approach that $50,000 a year or more. The second issue is in regard to utilization, meaning the disease prevalence is not the same thing as the treated prevalence. You know, we talk about a disease prevalence of 1 in 88, but not every child who likely has autism seeks treatment for it. From the information that we were able to gather across the country, and we estimate the actual utilization rate is about 30 to 40%, which is actually higher than some data that's come out of Minnesota. As you're probably aware, up until recently, because of a court order, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota was required to cover this treatment. And information from our providers here estimate the utilization rate may only be about 20%. So those things need to be considered when preparing the fiscal notes. After we got our data, we've also gotten data from the state of Missouri. As part of their law that required coverage, they also required that the Department of Insurance report back to the legislature the cost of their annual the cost of services for that year. Very similar to what we were finding in the other states, whereas we found an average of 31 cents, Missouri reported 25 cents per member per month. And obviously, you know, this is from their first year of implementation, and clearly they recognize that, you know, there's going to be a ramp up period, you know, that it's not going to be 25 cents per member per month every year. As the provider network grows and parents become more familiar with the benefit, you know, it is going to be more expensive. But even recognizing that, their comment in from the Department of Insurance was very unlikely that the cost for autism treatment will have an appreciable impact on premiums. The other comment that we received from some opponents of this legislation are that it's going to destroy small business. And this is a quote from one of our sponsors in Ohio who is a legislator but also a small business owner and says, you know, I've been a businessman my whole life, and 31 cents per member per month isn't going to put any business out on the street. If they do, they've got bigger problems than providing health insurance coverage for their employees. The other issue that I wanted to address is with regard to the Affordable Care Act. Some opponents will say, well, you can't do this because if you require coverage that exceeds the essential health benefits, then the state is going to be obligated to defray the cost of that. That is true to a degree. What's important to clarify is that the Affordable Care Act only requires that obligation to individual policies sold inside the exchange. So we would be able to, you know, the cost of requiring coverage to plans sold outside of the exchange would not trigger any obligation to defray the cost. So I think I speeded through that, and but I'm happy to answer any questions from the members of the committee.
Thank you very much. We have a question from Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Hey, thanks for your presentation. I'm a layperson on this, but, you know, back to the ACA, your last.
Yes.
So basically the ACA, the essential benefits, does not cover autism?
As currently interpreted by HHS.
Yeah, Mr. Wasmer, you have to go through the chair, so because taping it all.
Okay.
So go ahead.
So say that again.
Yeah, we have this little funny little procedure here that we have to do to make sure that we know who's speaking on the tape. So I have to call on you every time you speak.
Okay.
So please go ahead.
With regard to the ACA, currently as interpreted by HHS, the answer is no. If you look at the congressional testimony during the course of hearings for the ACA, there was an amendment made by Senator Menendez that amended the category of essential health benefits, substance abuse disorders, and substance abuse and mental health, mental health and substance abuse disorders. They amended that to say mental health and substance abuse disorders, including behavioral health treatment. And on the congressional record, his rationale for adding those four words was so that children with autism can receive coverage for applied behavior analysis. Unfortunately, as many of you are probably aware, the communication between HHS and the states has not been real clear, and they have yet to clarify that, in fact, the intent of that amendment was such that children could receive coverage. I work at the state level. We do have folks at the federal level who are continuing to have conversations with the HHS to try to get them to clarify that. But the answer is, as of now, no. And therefore, the benefits that are going to be proposed in the legislation that will be discussed tomorrow would exceed the essential health benefits. But what's important to remember is that that obligation to defray the cost only applies to those plans inside the exchange.
Okay. Just to follow up,
Representative Grunhagen.
Does MCHA cover it all, Minnesota Comprehensive, as far as state? I don't know if he'd know that or not,
yeah.
Madam Chair.
I don't know if Mr. Wasmer would know that, but let's see, maybe somebody from House Research would. Well,
well, we got some response.
We've got people in the audience telling us yes.
They didn't go through the chair, Madam Chair.
They didn't, that's right, so I don't know if they can officially say
Chairman,
that,
I'm going to say yes.
Mr. Wasmer, maybe you can.
All right. So, okay. I don't know if we can answer that by tomorrow, Madam Chair.
He's going to be in a light.
We can confirm that and get back with you, okay. Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you.
Right. Other questions from members? Okay. I'm Representative Schoen.
Madam Chair, Mr. Wasmer. First, I want to personally thank you for this presentation along with Representative Grunhagen. And I want to thank every person in this room that works on behalf of autism and the folks that and the kids that are growing up with it. One of the things that I've seen that positive therapy does is it's good for the parents. And that's a piece that we can't forget about as well. And just when kids grow at the rate they do, and their changes in their body and the needs of the medication changes that they need to survive and thrive. And then to think about, you're just sitting in church with your kid and they make a noise and they don't necessarily have a physical look to them like some other ailments maybe do. And people don't understand and they get the stares. And that's hard on parents. And I think that's a strong piece. And I'd be curious if you ever had any thoughts or any numbers associated with that as well, too, about the care that the parents need along there and what those costs to society are as well. And I look at this number here, and I think it's sad we haven't done this long ago.
Mr. Wasmer.
Madam Chair, members.
And to the audience, I know this is a really important topic to many of you, and we all appreciate your presence here, but we have decorum in the committee, so please no clapping, no outbursts. Thank you. Mr. Wasmer.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I appreciate your comments, and you're absolutely right. It clearly affects the whole family. As you mentioned, with autism, there is no physical distinction that is going to make it clear to someone who's not familiar with your situation from across the room that this is a child with a significant disability. As a personal example, when my daughter was younger, my son was just born. She was just diagnosed with autism. I had to run to the store to get something for my wife. She typically takes a particular route. She likes to take all the back roads, and I like a straight shot. I was driving down the road, and at the time that I passed the road that my wife normally takes, she cut loose. And it was, at the time, I didn't recognize why that was. Ultimately, I figured out it was because it was a different routine than she was used to. She was screaming so loud I thought she got stung by a bee. I pulled over, I checked her car seat, and it wasn't that. She cried all the way to the store. She cried all the way through the store. I was stopped three times, two parents and ultimately the store manager, asking me what was wrong. I thought that they were going to assume that I was abducting her because she was nonverbal. She's 3 years old, but she couldn't speak. And I was afraid that I was going to be at risk of being taken to jail. So clearly, it does affect the whole family. It affects the parents. It affects the siblings. With regard to the impact on cost, the answer is yes. There are some studies that demonstrate that parents of affected children earn less money for their job relative to parents who don't have an affected child. And a lot of that has, we talk about, you know, the long-term cost savings, the societal cost savings, the $3.2 million, but very rarely do we talk to your point, and that is that if a child receives the appropriate treatment, that affects the whole family, that minimizes the stress on the family, and ultimately that's going to make the parents more productive employees. So, you know, if we talk about the impact on small business, I think we have to consider the fact that there are also short-term cost savings that often aren't discussed.
Thank you, Mr. Wasmer. Other questions from members? Okay, well, thank you. We really so much appreciate your presence here today and your presentation, and good luck in your travels.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, next up is Alex Bartolik from the Department of Human Services. Welcome to the committee. And members, I could just pause here, first of all, to mention that we have a new member in the committee. Representative Lohmer is joining us, so welcome, Representative Lohmer. What a great day for you to join us, because I know you have a great interest in autism, so we appreciate your presence here today.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and you're right, I do have a good deal of interest in this, so it's good to be here. Thank you.
And also, members, it wasn't necessary in the last presentation. I think we were all pretty riveted, and we probably will be again, but I just wanted to say, if you do have questions, if they are clarifying questions, we can interrupt our speaker, but if you have larger questions, more substantive questions, let's wait till she gets through her presentation so that we don't get her too off track. So welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Alex Bartolik, and I'm with the Department of Human Services. I'm the Director for Disability Services, and one thing that is so evident on this topic is that as a department, we need to work collaboratively across all of our different divisions. So I am working with my colleagues in healthcare and in children's mental health, as with other parts of the department, as we're working together to look at the best way to provide services for people in general, but also particularly people on the autism spectrum disorder. You have had a pretty good overview of what autism is. I'm going to just give a little bit more information about that, and then I'm going to talk about what medical assistance covers currently with autism and provide you with some information. And I'll end with a little bit of some next steps. There's been a lot of work over the past year, and in part from legislation that passed last year, and just to let you know what's coming. As you just heard, autism spectrum disorder is a complex array of neurodevelopmental disorders, and people typically have deficits in communication, in their social interaction, and there's restrictive and repetitive behaviors and interests. So even though there's a set of characteristics that can be used to define people, it is a spectrum. And there's a wide variation of how these different characteristics will play out, can be from very mild to severe, and also the range of what those characteristics mean on a person's ability to go to school, to make friends, and what that means for lifelong. Autism has been viewed as a lifelong disability. However, there is emerging evidence that is beginning to suggest that earlier identification and early intervention for autism spectrum disorders that's based on the individual needs of the child can reduce the impact of the disorder on the lives of children and their families. It can improve children's ability to participate at school, to be able to get along with family members, to be able to participate with friends in their community. It can improve long-term outcomes, and it can also reduce the need for services later in life. And there's a very new study that suggests that effective early intervention in some cases can offer the possibility of reducing or even overcoming some of the challenges in the areas of social interaction and communication and behaviors for at least a small group of individuals so that they're able to go through school without the need for special education or further services. Despite promising support for early intervention, there's a lack of rigorous research in autism treatment that will help us identify what is the most effective treatment for an individual child in order to address the different symptoms that that child presents. There's variabilities in the signs and the symptoms of the disorder. That makes it difficult. We also have cultural, linguistic, and socioeconomic barriers that we have to bring into bear and that can add some complexity to our challenge. As you heard, autism is the fastest growing developmental disability. The Centers for Disease Control in 2012 showed the prevalence of 1 in 88, and this is compared to the prevalence of 1 in 150 children in 2002. So it is growing very rapidly. If we were to use the current census data with the overall number of children in Minnesota, which is 352,815 children who are under the age of 5, and applied these statistics, there would be over 4,000 children under the age of 5 with the disorder in Minnesota. In December of 2010, the Department of Human Services served 2,053 children between birth and the age of 5 years of age who are diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder. So it's really important as we look at how can we get earlier intervention in order to be able to really help us children earlier that we are able to make some strides from where we are. Now, medical assistance funds a lot of services that are used by people. During the development of Reform 2020, which I think you've been listening to with the budget presentations and which we will be coming to this committee, we were looking at how are we going to redesign our long-term services and supports in Minnesota to be able to better achieve individual outcomes, to be able to make sure people can get the right service at the right time, and that we have a sustainable service. It became very apparent that we really had to look at autism as we were going forward. We were able to look at all of the data. We looked at all the claims data across all of our medical assistance programs as well as our assessment information from our different programs in order to understand what was happening, and it was very clear that people with an autism spectrum disorder are accessing a wide range of services across our department. You do have a chart. There was a handout that came out. It's just a one-pager that says that it's an overview of autism, and there's just two charts on it. And I just want to reference the first chart just to give you a little bit of information about who is being served. Overall, our medical assistance programs are serving 17,454 individuals with autism spectrum disorder. Actually, that's not a current number. That was in 2010. Our data is from calendar year 2010. Approximately 58% of those were children who were under the age of 18. And we served 2,053 children who were 5 years old or younger. And so as you go through, it gives you an idea of the age brackets that we're serving. For children in 2010, between the ages of 6 and 17, we served slightly over 8,000 people, and it increased, and then between 18 and 20, just a little over 1,000. Adults from ages of 21 to 64, almost 5,500. So it's certainly clear that children are making up a large percentage of people that are coming on to medical assistance. Now, there's different ways people can become eligible for medical assistance, and I'm not going to go into all the details, but it might help a little bit as you think about different options. There are some people who have been certified as having a disability, and there's very specific criteria that goes through Social Security or a state process, a medical review team process, to look at whether or not the diagnosis is a disability that's intended to be lifelong, that prevents a person from working. So there's a rather rigorous standard for looking at disability. If they are certified as having a disability, then they are able to participate in medical assistance based on their income and asset requirements. Obviously, we don't want young children to have to be certified as disabled to also receive services, so there are some different ways of doing that. Children whose family income is higher than the eligibility criteria for medical assistance can still be found eligible through the TEFRA program. And that's where only the child's income is counted for eligibility, but then the parent's income, the family income, is taken into account to determine a parental fee that will be paid for accessing services. And then the third way of coming into medical assistance is for children and families who meet specific income and asset requirements, even if the child does not have a certified disability. When people are on medical assistance, they have access to health care that you would typically get, so being able to see a doctor. There also are therapies, occupational therapy, physical therapy, speech therapy that are available. We also have home and community-based services, the waivers. You've heard about that a little bit, the term waiver. For some of you who are new, started in the early 1980s when the federal government gave authority for states to say how they would like to provide community-based services for people who typically could only receive those services in institution, a nursing home, an intermediate care facility for people with developmental disabilities, or a hospital. Now, it's a number of years since when the term waivers first came into be, where that was kind of the exception to an institutional care. And actually, in Minnesota, people with disabilities, 94% of people live in live in the community. There's a very few number of people who actually live in a nursing home or intermediate care facility. So it's certainly the preference, and we're seeing that more and more, to receive services that allow people to stay at home with their families, or as they get older, to be able to live in the community more independently. We have 5 waiver programs in Minnesota, and 2 of them are programs that people with an autism spectrum disorder tend to access. One of them is the Community Alternatives for Disabled Individuals, or the CADI waiver program. This is for people who have a nursing home level of care, so they need assistance in order to be able to stay at home, to be able to work, to be able to go to school. And we also have a developmental disabilities waiver for people who might need additional support in an intermediate care facility for people with developmental disabilities. And it's talking about more of the habilitation or training in addition to needing ongoing support. Now, these 2 waiver programs serve a number of people. The DD waiver has, they both have restrictions on the number of people that can access it, and they both have waiting lists. So when we look at, I'm going to show you a chart in a moment, and when we look at who's accessing it, probably more people would be using the DD waiver, except there's been such waiting lists for that. Other programs that people might access include our Personal Care Assistance Program, or PCA. And PCA can help somebody who has needs. They might need help in taking care of themselves and dressing and getting around. We also have a counterpart called a Consumer Support Grant. So if somebody's eligible for personal care services, they can go through an agency and hire services. We do have the option for them to be able to have a lot of control over who they hire and use to support them. Or a family can choose to receive the state dollars only and be able to receive it in a grant that's called the Consumer Support Grant. And these are 2 programs that people also are accessing. There also is another program that people will use, which is called the Children's Therapeutic Services and Supports, or CTSS. CTSS is a flexible package of mental health services for children who require varying therapeutic or rehabilitative levels of intervention. CTSS services are intended to be time-limited. They're delivered using different treatment modalities and combinations in order to help somebody meet some outcomes that was identified in a treatment plan. The providers of the service are certified by DHS, specifically as CTSS providers, and there's a range of people who can meet those standards. On the one pager, there is a chart that shows what are some of the most common services that people who have an autism spectrum disorder tend to access. There are other services, but these are the most common. And when you look at it, it shows by age breakouts the number of people who in 2010, so this is a couple of years old, accessed the CADI waiver. And in this point, there were 47 children who were 5 years old or younger who accessed CADI. And then 657, if you look at adults, between the ages of 21 to 64 who were using the CADI program. The DD waiver is also an option for people, and from the ages of 6 to 17, there's over 1,000 children on the DD waiver in order to receive services that support them and their families. Personal care is something that is used by a number of people, and as you follow the numbers there, for very young children, there's 591 people who are accessing it. And it jumps up to over 3,000 people at the ages of 6 to 17. The Consumer Support Grant, again, is the counterpart to PCA, and there's a number of families particularly that will access that grant to support them. And then CTSS services tends to be, it is for children, and so you will see that in the numbers. You won't see adults using it, but certainly between the ages of 6 and 17 is the largest number of people using it at over 2,000. And so overall, when we look at this, our personal care program and the consumer support grant and CTSS are more likely to be accessed by families with younger children. And then adults are more likely to use services through one of the waivers. And the waivers typically provide the ongoing residential and employment support for folks. Now, to know that the school systems also are providing services, and the school systems can have a process where they can be reimbursed for some of the medical assistance services that are provided through the schools. So these numbers are talking about people who access medical assistance through their MA benefit. There's been a lot of interest in autism, certainly with the numbers going and a lot of new research and studies looking at different ways of going on. I want to just give you an example of some of the activities that are underway, knowing that there will be some additional bills that come forward. Last year, the legislature asked the Health Services Advisory Council, which is the council that advises the Department on Medical Assistance Coverage and is chaired by our medical director is involved with that through our health care division. But the Health Care Advisory Council was mandated to address and look at autism spectrum disorders. And they were specifically charged to review the evidence base for various treatments for autism spectrum disorders across the lifespan, to recommend ongoing collection of outcome evidence, and recommend coverage parameters for autism spectrum disorder intervention. And say they are completing their report, and that is certainly something that is informing other activities about how can we provide services. There also was a report requested last year to look at the housing and service needs for children with severe autism. Our goal, and certainly the public policy across the state for many decades, has been to support families, to assure that families are getting the support that they need and the schools are able to provide support to children. But there are situations where children do need to live in out-of-home placements. And so there was a study that was done to look at what is going on across the country, what are the options for services and housing, what's being done in Minnesota, what does some of the research show, and trying to look at what options Minnesota should make available in that situation. Certainly there's the legislative task force, which I'm not going to mention because you're going to get a presentation on that. And then also, as we were looking at Reform 2020, what do we need to do to reform our medical assistance system to be able to get better outcomes and help make sure it's sustainable into the future? Autism was something we looked at quite a bit. We did a lot of analysis. We contracted with Truven Analytics to look at all of the data to help us understand what people were accessing, what were the characteristics, what were the combination of services, and it is clear that people come into the system from a lot of different ways, and they probably have never known in a comprehensive way what is the best service to meet their needs at that particular point in time. We contracted with the University of Minnesota to help us work with all of the different stakeholders. We had a rather large advisory committee who met during the fall to help provide us with some better information, and we'll be continuing to work with stakeholders to really understand how can we look at a lot of different research that's going on, knowing that in many cases there isn't the type of robust research that would point us in one direction, and how can we move forward and develop evidence for practices as we go forward. We also have been working with other state agencies, and a lot of ways with Department of Health, with education, with rehabilitative services, really trying to understand how can we assure that when people come to the system, come to public services, that we are working in a more collaborative way and holistically addressing people's needs. And so we're going to continue these efforts. We do have some things that will be coming before this committee on looking at different services that we think will help complement the array of services that we currently have. And our biggest charge with all of this, which is also mentioned earlier, we have to do earlier intervention. The average age of diagnosis is around age 4, and this is too late. We need to be able to do much earlier diagnostic and identification of children in order to be able to start providing good early intervention services.
Thank you very much, Ms. Bartolik. I see we've got some questions here. First, Representative Mullery, then Representative Ulmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two questions. First of all, what percentage of people that have autism at some point first exhibit it as adults?
Ms. Bartolik.
Madam Chair and Representative, that's a good question, and I'm just going to see if any of my experts have any information. I don't know the answer off the top of my head. If somebody here knows it, they'll let me know. Otherwise, we will get back to you with that. So you're saying how many people don't have a diagnosis as a child or even as they're growing up, but it becomes evident as an adult. Somehow they learn that they have this diagnosis or they're given the diagnosis?
Basically, that's the question. Second question, what does the state look at positively or negatively, the research going on? I know Harvard Medical School is doing quite a bit of tying foods that we're now eating to autism. Has the state looked into that at all, as to have a view on that, or...
Ms. Bartolik.
Madam Chair and Representative, the Health Services Advisory Committee looked at a lot of the different research, and we know that there's a lot of variables and a lot of approaches that people are using. And there's some promising practices, but I think we're really wanting to see some better evidence and ways of building evidence to understand what is working and how it's working and when it's working to be able to look at that.
Representative Mullery? Okay.
Oh, Madam Chair, that's the end.
Okay, thank you. Representative Lohmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Bartolik, for that report. I think last year we had, as part of the omnibus bill, a study that you referred to, and I think it was due the middle of January, and I know there's been a bit of a delay. Can you tell us when that will be ready and when we can have a look at that?
Mm-hmm. Ms. Bartolik.
Madam Chair and Representative Lohmer, you know, despite our best efforts to meet our timelines, we periodically have some issues. We've been making the report accessible in order to put it on the web. So it is written. It's in the final points of the clearance, and I hope that it would be up by the end of the month.
Okay. Other questions, members? Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a quick question. I wondered about out-of-placement out-of-home placement. What facilities in Minnesota are there? And is Laura Baker one of them in Northfield? Is that still one of them?
Ms. Bartolik.
Madam Chair and Representative Fritz, the report that's coming out is going to talk about the different types of services. In Minnesota, we certainly know that children with an autism spectrum disorder may be served in an intermediate care facility for people with developmental disabilities. Most of those do not specialize in autism, but they may be a home, and Laura Baker is one of those. Most children who are in an out-of-home placement in Minnesota typically are living in some type of small foster care setting and receiving home and community-based services that wrap around with providers who have some expertise around autism.
And Representative Pritz.
Madam Chair, and to that point, I have a constituent who has a child, I believe he's probably in his 20s now, who they were going to place in Laura Baker, and that was around $300,000 a year for them to place him, and he stayed home. And the wife and mother has always stayed home and never been able to work in all of those years to care for him. So the cost is huge. in caring for these folks. Just wanted to make that point.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Fritz. Representative Muller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just thought of another one. And I haven't looked into for a few years, but there were working on mental health issues, going to some of the homes for people with mental health issues, and they get them jobs. I was told that they have, several of them have light forms of autism. Are we still doing that? And who pays? Is it through mental health that they get the money support, or through the fact they have some autism, or how does that work as far as payment?
Ms. Bartolik.
Madam Chair and Representative Mullery, is the question about if somebody needs support to be able to work, how do we provide that support? That actually could be done in a number of different ways. The schools are certainly putting a lot of effort into how to help children, and there's a big focus on some different practices to support youth with autism spectrum disorders and being able to gain some good skills in being able to go out into employment. The Department of Economic Development certainly also has, through the rehabilitation services, they will do assessment and assisting people with developing skills and getting into jobs. And then many of our services do. Our home and community-based services will provide supported employment, will provide job coaching, will help people get into services. There are some programs through a number of different areas within the department where we are focused on trying to help people be able to work. It is certainly through employment that we're going to be able to help people be more economically self-sufficient, but also it just leads to so many good outcomes in addition to the financial rewards. So I think it would almost depend on how people, what their needs were as to what array of services we would look at to try to support them.
Thank you.
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Ms. Bartolik. My question, I've had the privilege of serving on the Autism Spectrum Disorder Task Force, and so one thing that I have learned and has become very clear is that a one-size-fits-all for this issue certainly does not work just by the sheer nature of the term spectrum within the name of the disorder. Makes it very difficult. The one question I had was, and I don't know if you'll have the answer to this, or I know Mr. Trahan is testifying next, and I know the data is out there, I just haven't seen it. Is there something, either specifically in Minnesota or nationally, that shows the long-term sustainability, or kids that have gone through ABA therapy, the success rates, and how does that, if they, successful treatment in those 3 to 4 years of treatment that they recommend, but that's pretty much a long-term solution or fix that at that point they're more or less streamlined into the education system. Is there a study or report or data that you could point us to just to kind of get our heads around that particular issue?
Ms. Bartolik.
Madam Chair and Representative, there's going to be a lot of studies out there. Actually, the Health Services Advisory Council that I mentioned, their report, is it out yet, Jeff, or soon to be out? It'll be out soon, and we can get you copies of it. It will show their review of the different research and evidence that's out there and where there's promising practices and areas that we would like to actually build evidence in Minnesota so that we're not waiting for the perfect research study to help us understand it. And the complexity of it is, as you just said, it's a wide range, it's a wide spectrum of needs, and how do we really approach this in a way that allows us to customize services also means you can't generalize results across everybody. We do need to build research, but there is some good information that was gone through, and you might find that to be helpful.
Yeah. And Ms. Bartolik, I do have a question as well, and that is going back to this table that you gave us, the one pager, and I have to admit I find it even though I've been doing this a while, I still find this very confusing, and I'm sure other people do too, with all these acronyms and what the different programs are. And so I just want to ask you, and given that you heard the last presentation we had and we were talking about insurance coverage, so, you know, if I'm, say, a middle-class family and have private insurance and have a child that is diagnosed with autism, what are my options? Supposing that my private insurance doesn't cover that any of the services or doesn't cover services that my doctor tells me that my child needs, what happens? How do I, I'm assuming there's some accessing then of MA services under TEFR. Could you just explain what happens to me in that, what happens to my family in that circumstance? Where do we go?
So, Madam Chair, the first place that you could go to is your school system. Obviously, the schools have a mandate to serve everyone and to be able to work with them to look at what services can be available through the school system. And we do, as I said, the schools can sometimes access medical assistance services and bring some components in. So that would be a first place to really look at what can be available through the services that the child is entitled to and the family can access. If there were additional services and out-of-pocket was too significant, medical assistance is an option to see first if the child met some of the criteria to be able to access medical assistance as having a disability, and then there would be a parental fee on that process. And one of the things that we want to do and that we will be bringing forward some information at a future hearing is how can we better have one point of contact so you don't have to, you shouldn't have to as a parent think about what service might be best. You just need to know who you can go to and get some help. Obviously, our county services are our point of access for medical assistance, both for financial eligibility, but also to get assessments to look at what might be the appropriate service, whether it's through a mental health service or through a waiver or PCA. And so the county is the entity, if you're looking at publicly funded services, that would help do some of the assessments and look at what options are available for you.
So, and Ms. Bartolik, so thank you for that. And what I hear in that a little bit is that there's some delay here. And because especially if I'm going to be accessing the school system or going to them, my child might be preschool at that point. And so, but I'm not, and I know you're not saying I have to wait till my child gets to be school age, but in the figuring out of what my options are, it sounds like there's some delay, and perhaps that's what the department is looking at, how to, as you're saying, streamlining it and trying to get rid of as much delay as possible to get that child into services just as quickly as possible. Is that kind of what I'm hearing?
Madam Chair, there shouldn't be a delay. So, yes, we want to improve our system, but Minnesota, from birth on, if children have special needs, there is an obligation and a collaboration that occurs between the school system and health, particularly local public health and social services. So when I talk about accessing the school, if there was a child with a disability that was known at birth, the school could be involved at that point. There does not need to be a waiting for school age to get involved with the school system. It's just for children who are younger, birth to three, for example, with that really early intervention, we try to look at it pretty collaboratively and try to figure out what system is going to be able to offer the best support. And having said all of that, again, our rates of early identification and diagnosis are later than we want to see.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to draw your attention to your one-page handout. I'm just looking at the first graph. I'm wondering if you could speak to the bracketing. You've got 18 to 20-year-olds with individuals with the ASD condition of 1,269, but then you move to 21 through 64, mm-hmm. 5,475, and then 65 plus 6567. I guess it's a two-part question. One is this just symptomatic of the diagnoses being more contemporary in the last few years, and that's why we're seeing kind of a mushrooming of the people being diagnosed? And then the follow-on to that would be, is there a connection between ASD and mortality based upon the fall off after 65?
Ms. Bartola.
Madam Chair, Representative, first of all, to know we came up with these age cohorts during our work with our Reform 2020. And part of why we ended up with these groupings is we were trying to understand what other services children might access. So we tried to break up to kind of an earlier intervention, the birth to five, versus more of your traditional school age, 6 to 17. The 18 through 20 is typically considered a transition age. There's a number of children who may graduate, but we really are looking at that age. So the cohorts, we could have cut it in different ways. It's just then we got into adult services. So that's why we chose those particular cohorts, for us to understand what other systems the person might be involved with. I think what you're seeing here is really the prevalence of the incidents and the question of, are there more people who were not diagnosed earlier who we don't recognize in our system that we might, if they came in as a child today, diagnose them? Or is the incidence really just increasing, which seems as though it is? So certainly when you look at these younger groups, we were probably getting better identification, better diagnosing, and then also increased incidence that was coming on. This data also is based on what we have in our assessment information and what diagnostic code is on our claims data. And so we put it all together to say, if somewhere in there we start getting this diagnosis, we can assume that somewhere this is prevalent, but it probably is not. It does not represent a thorough multidisciplinary diagnosis to assure this is the correct diagnosis.
Okay, does that help? I'm kind of looking at the clock here because I want to give Mr. Trahan some time, but do you need a follow-up?
I'll defer to later. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Ms. Bartola. I appreciate it. Okay, so we're going to move on now to Bradley Trahan, who is from the Executive Director of RT Autism Awareness Foundation, which just happens to be in Rochester, but he also is the chair of the task force that we have just heard a little bit about, and he's going to tell us a little bit about the findings of the task force. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you so much. My name is Brad Trahan. As mentioned, Executive Director of the RT Autism Awareness Foundation, also the chair of the Minnesota Autism Task Force. I would also be remiss not to mention I'm also the father of a son named Reese with severe autism that was diagnosed 10 years, six days ago to this day. While he's on the severe end, he's made tremendous progress, still nonverbal, still in diapers, but he's made tremendous progress. And as a parent, too, I think I appreciate Representative Schoen's comments earlier about how it affects the family and the siblings, where my wife and I speak for many parents and siblings that we've not had a vacation in 16 years of our marriage. And after one trying morning just a few weeks ago, I received a text from my 14-year-old son that said, "Dad, I wish Reese didn't have autism. I wish our family was normal. And if there's one thing I can do to accomplish in my lifetime, it's to cure autism." So it's a heavy burden on our families and our siblings. Certainly, I was honored to chair the task force, and it was under a legislative mandate from 2011. The task of Minnesota legislature directed us to develop an autism spectrum disorder statewide strategic plan that focuses on improving awareness, early diagnosis, and intervention, and to ensure delivery of treatment services for individuals diagnosed with that spectrum, including the coordination, accessibility of cost-effective treatments and services throughout the individual's lifetime. I'm very happy that on page 13 of the handout that you'll see the membership of our list, but it was very clear that early on, two things that we really wanted to do as a task force was to unite the autism community. I think you'll see moving forward this legislative session, you'll see great unification amongst therapy providers, advocates, and so on. With the help of this task force, it should be noticed when the strategic plan was put together, nothing was left out. This task force actually originated in 2009 via Senate resolution. So all the work that was done in 2009 and 2010 and 2011 was also implemented in this ending report. We're mandated by legislation to submit this report to the governor's office on January 15th of this past year, January 15th of 2014, and January 15th of 2015, unless that's continued by law, the task force will then end. As you'll see in front of you, I think it's important to note out on page one, though, according from the Minnesota Department of Education, back in 2011, Minnesota schools reported 15,378 individuals that met the criteria for ASD and were receiving special ed services, which is 12% of the statewide special education population. And the special education identification of ASD individuals aged birth to 21 has increased more than 300% since 2001. As we rolled this out, it was on page two, you'll see that of the vision, we identified nine elements, and we feel this is very important for you guys to take a look at. When you really take a look at this task force report, especially for some that may not be somewhat new to autism, it's quite honestly, it's a checklist. It's a cheat sheet of a lot that has to go on. Well, there is nine vision elements that were identified, and amongst all those vision elements, there's 31 subpoints of work that we could possibly do to get it done. With that said, now the next 2 years between this year and next year, it's the task force job to take this plan and these elements and try and start to implement it. We're under a legislative mandate to do that. But it's important, I want to identify for the record, the nine vision elements are early, timely, and continuous accessible screening and assessment. B, to be well-informed, empowered, and supported families and caregivers. C, the coordination of services. D, transition to adulthood. E, access to services throughout the state. F, competent practitioners and supportive communities. G, funding support families. H, data-informed policy. And finally, I, ongoing emphasis on implementation of the strategic plan. At the invitation of the governor at a luncheon, who was very much on his radar, simply he was asking us what he could do to help. And the task force came up with four things that we put in our letter to the governor and to legislative leadership. And I should note for transparency reasons, the state departments and any legislative members on the task force abstained from this discussion due to their own policy efforts and how they go about business and their budgets and whatnot. But we came up with four elements that we did submit to the governor that we would like to see in his budget. Number one, we did ask as a whole that it now is time to pass autism private insurance reform. To answer your question earlier, Chair, what happens is while there is an option for families to use the public school system, our autism population is simply overwhelming our public school system. Many of them are still not receiving the type of medically prescribed therapy that they're supposed to get. So while our schools are doing they're simply doing the best they can for what they have. So really, it's not what truly families need. Basically, the burden has simply been put on the families. That's where it comes. It's been put on the families. And while we could access the consumer support grant, that's based on parental fees. The more you make, the more you pay in. In our personal case, we had to take our son off of it because while we were paying the cost of living, while we had our own health insurance policy we were paying for, it got up to over $900 per month for us to keep on paying for our son to continue his services. We had to make a decision to keep the roof over our head and food on the table or stop his therapy. So we stopped his therapy. We wish he could have got more. And I simply said, I want to remind everyone, this is just one example of many other parents, what they're going through. So we are asking as a whole. Now, while the task force, what I can say, while the task force, it took the position that we would like to see this finally pass, while the language is being rolled out, we will reconvene the task force to take a look at it to get their endorsement of it. But at a certain time when the synopsis, I don't want to mislead anybody and say that they're supporting the language because the language hasn't been rolled out yet, but they agree in whole that it should be passed. Number two, we heard this since 2009. We need a website, an objective website. We're hearing this from our medical providers. We're hearing it from social services. We're hearing it from our schools that we need an objective website so we can help navigate the system better. When you get that diagnosis, it's so overwhelming. There's so much information out there. And we kind of envision a statewide map. So if someone gets that diagnosis, they could go to their county and learn who their public health nurse is, learn who their educational supports are, and even learn what services are out there for us to access. They don't know what to do. So we put in there to actually, let's develop a statewide website to make it easier and make it objective. Number three, autism license plates. We want to create legislation. This has not been rolled out, but it will be, to create autism license plates to perhaps maybe fund those websites and maybe fund number four, an autism commission. We want to find a way to generate revenue to also give back to autism-related services. So while we come here and know that there's a financial related services, so while we come here and know that there's a financial impact, it's also important to know, and this was brought up earlier, what I can say from studies, and you'll learn this as we move forward, it is known that with early and intense intervention, it could be a cost savings up to two-thirds to our taxpayers and to our families. So that's important. I think that question was earlier asked. It's a savings up to two-thirds. So the autism license plate, you'll see that as well. And finally, the Autism Commission. It is the fastest growing developmental disability our nation faces today. There's been great previous work done by the Minnesota Autism Study Groups and the task forces. And it's important to know that we respectfully submit that in 2013 we would seek support to change the current Minnesota Autism Task Force into an Autism Commission. Those are the four things that we've highlighted and submitted to the governor. We've not received a reply under his review at that point, but we feel that that is important. I have learned that while the details are being worked out, that it's our understanding that there is $12 million in the governor's budget related to autism services. Everything else with that has to be rolled out as far as the kind of the nuts and bolts of that. So that's pretty much a wrap-up. It's now our job to take this pack that you see in front of you in the next 2 years. We start convening again on Tuesday to take these nine elements and all the 31 sub-points and try and take this strategic plan and now implement it. And I have to say that I want to commend the State Departments with the Education, Human Services, Health, and Deed. Fantastic help, very great communication. The advocates, the board, there was a big-time collaborative effort with this task force. And I will be honest with you, for the first time in 10 years, I'm very happy to see the progress that's being made. There's great engagement going on. And I thank you for this opportunity. And I can certainly address any questions for you at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Trahan. And I, you know, especially knowing, as you described, you know, the intensity of your family's needs and your need to be there, I really appreciate that you took the time not only to be with us today, but to chair the task force. And I encourage members to read the report because I, you know, it's not a heavy read, but it has a lot of very good information in it. So thank you very much. Questions for members? Yeah, Representative Grunhag.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, Mr. Taylor, you talked about, you know, being faced with the choice of $900 a month for the treatment or having a roof over your head. Did you look at the option of trying to get coverage through Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association?
Mr. Trahan.
Madam Chair, I apologize. Yes, Madam Chair and Representative, we've looked at avenues. What we were told, you know, with our son assigned a social worker, and they said that they looked at all avenues possible to us, and it would not be affordable for us to take that avenue. I will say that we did access the consumer support grant. Our son did receive ABA therapy, and that was covered on the consumer support grant.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions, members? Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Tran, thank you for coming. His parents are my friends. They live in my hometown. And they're the grandparents of Reese. And so I hear about the Tran family in Rochester and the incredible work that you've done your entire life. And I know you've never had a vacation. And when you say that, he says it honestly because he doesn't. And the grandparents also are very involved in your life and the life of your son. And I just wanted to ask where Reese is today and how is he doing today?
Mr. Trahan.
Madam Chair, Representative Fritz, thank you very much, and thank you for the work you do. Reese is currently in the public school system. We're very fond of the public school system, and you know, we feel that he was cheated out of his therapy early on. We wonder where he'd be today had he received it. Quite honestly, we're under a self-insured plan, so this wouldn't benefit us, but at the same token, history has shown that when private insurance mandates are put into effect, self-insurance plans do follow suit. I also want to add that, trust me, we're also taking on self-insured plans for them to pay their burden as well. It's just not, it's got to be fair playing field here. Reese is in public, he's living with us, and quite honestly, he'll, barring a miracle, he'll have to be put in permanent living someday. And it's hard for a parent to do such a thing. When parents are sending kids off to college and things like that, you get it. But parents have so much burden. We have to create trust for our kids. We have to, you know, our kids are with autism are going to enter the criminal judicial justice system at some point in their lives. Witnesses, victims, defendants, trust, guardianship. And just when he turns 18, we're going to have to hire an attorney just to retain guardianship of our own son. So these are the types of stressors that families face going forward, and we want to just try and simplify it, make it easier for them. He's at home living with us. The past 4 months have probably been the most intense 4 months of our lives since Reese's diagnosis. 12 years old, you go through some life changes. And it's frustrating as a parent that you're doing everything you can to help your child, but when they don't communicate with you, you troubleshoot, you do the best you can. But you do, I'll be honest with you, there's a time that I feel like a sense of failure if I'm not meeting his needs, and it's hard. And that's why there's so many of us parents and advocates that we're not well parents, we're just advocates doing the best we can for our kids, because simply one day, friends, we're not going to be here. My wife and I, we're going to pass. The burden of Reese will be put on his siblings, and it's tough. It's really tough. So if we could put all of our work and energy into what we're doing right now and make some change statewide and make it easier for our kids, our sons and daughters, so when we do pass and the future diagnosis of these kids, then you know what? Then it's worth every minute of it. Thank you.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I think since I'm not seeing any more questions, Mr. Trahan, thank you. That's actually a very excellent note on which to end this hearing. And once again, I really thank you for coming and everybody who came and testified and attended today. And we will be hearing the bill tomorrow. And I'm sure that we will hear more about autism and other things that we can do to help solve these issues as we go on. Thank you.
Thanks, Madam Chair.
We're adjourned.